and welcome to History by Hollywood, a podcast series that examines the real events and people behind fact-based movies. This is episode number one for the 5th of February 2017, and today's movie is Ridley Scott's Gladiator. My name is Martin Darlington, and with me, as ever, is Andrew Blishick.
Let's start with a correction. In the introduction show, we said that our Twitter address was at History by Hollywood, but that is incorrect, as we use too many characters. The correct address is History by Hwood, and you can follow us there, where new episodes, ideas and suggestions will be tweeted regularly, and where you can question, criticise and suggest. And we do encourage you to criticise. We would like to create a podcast that is both informative and entertaining, but this is an organic creation, needs your fertiliser to flourish and develop. So if you'd like us to do something we're not, or stop doing something that you don't like, then please let us know.
If you do enjoy the show and want to support it through assisting with the admittedly modest costs of podcasting, you can donate by going to the website at www.historybyhollywood.com, go to the About page and hit the Buy Now button. And actually all you're buying is our gratitude. It should read donate, but we're still learning how to do all this stuff. Thank you, and without further ado, here is the show.
The story of the movie. Gladiator is a big budget blockbuster movie released in 2000. It was directed by Ridley Scott, of Blade Runner and Thelma and Louise fame, and the man behind a lot of other successful Hollywood movies and TV series. It stars Russell Crowe in the title Gladiator role and Joaquin Phoenix as the Emperor Commodus. In addition, it features Oliver Reed in his last movie role, as well as Derek Jacobi, who first came to prominence in another Roman historical epic, BBC's I, Claudius TV show from the 1970s. It was both a critical and financial success, produced for about $100 million and taking over $450 million at the box office. It won a slew of awards in 2000, including Oscars for Best Picture and Best Actor for Russell Crowe, his first Academy Award after missing out the year before when he was nominated for the whistleblowing role of Jeffrey Wigand in The Insider. Rotten Tomatoes gives it an aggregate 75% positive critical reviews, and its Metacritic score is a creditable 64 out of a possible 100. Set in Rome in the 2nd century AD, it was shot principally in England, Morocco and Malta.
The movie starts with an impressive battle scene set on the northern edge of the Roman Empire in 180 AD, where the current emperor, Marcus Aurelius, played by Richard Harris, is directing a battle against the Germanic barbarians in an effort to expand and secure the boundaries of the empire. The battle's led on the ground by General Maximus Decimus Meridius, played by Russell Crowe, and carefully watched by, from the sidelines by the Emperor's son and heir, Commodus, played by Joaquin Phoenix. When the ailing Emperor indicates that he intends to appoint Maximus as ruler to succeed him, Commodus smothers his father and publicly assumes the title of Emperor and seeks Maximus's declaration of loyalty. Maximus, suspecting the truth about the death of the Emperor, declines, and is immediately sentenced to death by the new self-proclaimed emperor. Maximus escapes execution and flees to his family farm way off in idyllic rural Spain. But he arrives home only to discover Commodus arranged for some imperial guards to murder Maximus's family and burn his farm to the ground, thereby setting up a motive for the noble Maximus to eventually seek retribution against the evil and insecure tyrant Commodus, who has by now returned to Rome, thinking Maximus and his entire family have been destroyed.
Meanwhile, slave traders capture the grieving Maximus, take him to North Africa, and sell him to the gladiator trainer Proximo, played by Oliver Reed, who died soon after filming this, his last movie role. Proximo correctly identifies Maximus as a military man via a distinctive army tattoo on his forearm, and assumes he is a deserter seeking anonymity on the fringes of the empire. Originally reluctant to take on the bloody and socially reviled role of gladiator, Maximus eventually accepts Proximo as something of a mentor and gradually uses his military skills to fight admirably in the arena and become a local hero to the crowds. Maximus, known simply as the Spaniard, to his gladiatorial colleagues and his cheering, bloodthirsty crowds, fights side by side with other press-ganged gladiatorial colleagues, including Hagen, a Germanic barbarian, and Juba, a Numidian hunter.
Meanwhile, Commodus, now back in Rome, proclaims 150 days of games and arena spectacles in honour of his dead father and Commodus's new rule. So Proximo, the trainer, thinks there'll be an opportunity to take his off-Broadway provincial gladiatorial show to the big time, and Commodus's 150-day spectacular show. Knowing that the new emperor will personally supervise the games on show, Maximus senses the possibility of a revenge opportunity. He signs up, and the Spaniard and his entourage make their way to Rome.
So the story's focus now shifts to Rome for the remainder of the movie. We learn Commodus has chosen the path of demagogue over that of his father, who acted as an august defender of Rome's traditional institutions. This is exemplified via the character of Senator Gracchus, played by veteran British actor Derek Jacobi. Commodus dismisses Gracchus and all that the Senate represents, and Gracchus in turn sees Commodus's appeal to the mob and the military for the realpolitik that it is. And to further convince us that Commodus is unhinged, there's a strong suggestion in the movie of desired incest with his older sister, Lucilla, an evidence of his pure sadism at an execution of his rivals. When the games begin, Commodus's character has been cast, and we're locked in for an expected ride to Revenge Town.
When the Spaniard and his troop finally appear in the Colosseum, it's part of a reenactment of Rome's brutal defeat of its longtime North African rival Carthage in 149 BC. So even for the audience then, this was ancient history. However, things don't quite follow the expected script. In this retelling, due to Maximus's military training, it's the North African newcomers who defeat the Romans in the arena. A delighted Commodus wants to congratulate the underdog gladiatorial visitors in person, and he enters the floor of the Colosseum to meet the victors face to face. After a little reluctance, Maximus removes his helmet and defiantly announces himself to the stunned emperor. The delighted mob, clearly and vocally in support of the Spaniard, prevent Commodus from immediately issuing a second execution order on the resurrected Maximus.
In the next gladiatorial match, Commodus brings out a retired and undefeated champion to vanquish Maximus once and for all. But Maximus eventually gets the upper hand and, in a classical thumbs up or thumbs down scene, is ordered by the emperor to kill off the until then undefeated champion. Maximus, of course, defies the order, further ingratiating with the masses, who now dub him Maximus the Merciful. With his newfound fame in Rome, word spreads to some of Maximus's old army buddies, who reach out to him through his ex-orderly Cicero. A plot emerges between Maximus, Senator Gracchus, and Lucilla, the emperor's sister, to do away with Commodus and return the rule of Rome to the Senate, and thereby to the Roman people. Commodus gets wind of the plot and orders the arrest of Gracchus and Maximus. However, at great sacrifice by Proximo's men, Maximus escapes to meet up with Cicero and his army buddies. But Commodus again gets the upper hand when Maximus is captured at the meeting place, and in an ego-driven ploy to win the adoration of the mob, Commodus challenges Maximus to a gladiatorial duel in the arena. Never one to play fair, Commodus seeks to ensure victory by actually stabbing Maximus in the back before the duel commences. So a weakened Maximus still manages to defeat the emperor, who is now swordless. Cowering before Maximus, Commodus has one last dirty trick to play and produces a concealed knife to finish off the general. And in his last superhuman act, Maximus turns the blade onto the emperor's throat, and the tyrant dies before the crowd at the Colosseum. Revenge now fulfilled, the stabbed and bloody Maximus sinks to the floor and dies in the arena.
In one of the final scenes of the movie, we see a dreamlike sequence where Maximus is reunited with his family in the Elysian fields of the Roman afterlife. Gracchus and Lucilla appear on the floor of the Colosseum, proclaiming with the death of the emperor the senatorial and therefore popular rule of Rome is restored. The movie ends with Maximus's body carried out of the arena for a military funeral, while Commodus's unloved corpse is ignored. Roll credits. Okay, so let's look at the historical background. Just to set the scene, one thing I think we need to think about is this happened nearly 200 years after the birth of Christ. So it's 180 CE or AD. Julius Caesar's reign was over 200 years before, but when we say reign, he was never actually an emperor. He was a dictator, and his rule as dictator really marks the end of the Republic of Rome, which had already lasted over 700 years at that stage. He adopted his nephew Octavian, who became known as Augustus, and he's the person that most historians will recognize as the first Roman emperor. He was a good emperor. After him, there were some bad, some good. But the period we're looking at is the end of a period known as the Five Good Emperors. And this lasted for 84 years, from 96 CE to 180 CE. Nerva was the first of the Five Good Emperors. He then adopted and chose a son called Trajan. When I say a son, in the Roman society, if you adopted someone, that was as good as being a natural born son. They didn't differentiate.
And you could even adopt somebody in your will. That's exactly what Julius Caesar did to Octavian. He chose his successor after he was dead.
Yeah.
And he was recognized by Roman society as good as his natural born son, but there was no bloodline involved at all.
No, and the adoptive son would usually take on the father's name. So the person we think of as Octavian and then Augustus, whose name is actually Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus, the very last bit differentiating him from his illustrious adopted father. So we had Nerva, who adopted Trajan. Trajan adopted Hadrian, he of the wall building. Hadrian then adopted Antonius Pius, but only on the understanding that Antonius Pius must adopt Marcus Aurelius, who Hadrian had already identified as being a very suitable successor, but he just felt he was a bit young. As it turned out, Antonius Pius lived from 66, I think he was, when Hadrian adopted him, so quite old to be your son. He lived for another 20 years, or maybe it was 46 and lived to 66. I'll have to look that one up. I'm sure a listener will be able to tell us. So he lived a lot longer than expected. So Marcus Aurelius was in his 40s before he took over. Now, initially, he reigned with his adoptive brother Lucius Verus, and they were both adopted by Antonius Pius. Verus was a fine soldier, but more interested in hunting, drinking, and basically having a good time than the day-to-day running of an empire. However, they were very fond of each other. They held each other in great respect, and Marcus Aurelius always paid him all the due respect to a co-emperor. He even married Verus to his own daughter, Lucilla, and this is the Lucilla we see in the film Gladiator, portrayed by Connie Nielsen. As depicted in the film, Verus died before he reached 40, possibly from food poisoning, but more likely from smallpox, which was probably the Antonine Plague.
And so we've got Lucius Verus already mentioned as a co-ruler with Marcus Aurelius. He married Marcus Aurelius's sister, Lucilla, from the movie.
Marcus Aurelius' daughter.
Daughter, thank you, from the movie, portrayed in the movie, as you say, by Connie Nielsen.
That's right, we'll edit that out. No, no, we won't. We'll leave it in. We're only human.
But the son, Lucilla's son in the movie, his name is also Lucius Verus. So there are two historical Lucius Veruses in the movie, and there are also two historical Lucius Veruses. That is factually correct. They got that right. And the son in the movie did die at a young age, but historically they got both those names correct.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it's quite impressive. The thing that marks out Marcus Aurelius, other than being considered by many historians as one of the greatest emperors and certainly the most thoughtful, was really a bit of a black mark against him, is he chose his natural son Commodus to be his successor. Marcus Aurelius is known as the philosopher emperor, mainly because he wrote a series of notes to himself, we think really for guidance, never intended them to be published. But they survived to the modern era. They've been given a number of names, but most people know them as the Meditations. There are 12 volumes of them, and they kind of reflect his attitude as a Stoic. A Stoic is someone who basically believes in gaining virtue through knowledge and just accepting the ups and downs of everyday life without complaints, without grumbling, without feeling how unfair it is, but also in believing in the Roman gods, which Marcus Aurelius as emperor would have definitely done, or certainly would have appeared in public to have done, but also a higher authority. Some early Christian writers have claimed that his belief in a power higher than the Roman gods show he was in fact an early Christian, but he did persecute the Christians quite a lot, so that would seem to contradict this idea.
One thing the movie does get right is that Marcus Aurelius did indeed die on campaign, fighting German tribes on the empire's northern border. And rumours did arise after the death that Commodus, who had been with his father at the time, had murdered him or had him murdered. But we don't have any real tangible evidence of this. And although Russell Crowe's character, Maximus Decimus Meridius, is a fictional creation, it's interesting to hear the offer made to him by the ageing emperor.
I want you to become the protector of Rome after I die. I will empower you to one end alone, to give power back to the people of Rome and end the corruption that has crippled it. Would you accept this great honor that I have offered you?
With all my heart, no.
Maximus, that is why it must be you.
But surely a prefect, a senator, somebody who knows the city, who understands her politics.
But you have not been corrupted by her politics.
And Commodus?
Commodus is not a moral man. You have known that since you were young. Commodus cannot rule. He must not rule.
So very commendable, and Marcus Aurelius is going to disinherit his own son and offer the role to Maximus. And I love the bit where he says, where Maximus says, absolutely no. He says, that's exactly why you should get the job. And I've often thought this for members of parliament, the British parliament, or any governmental position, the fact you want to do the job should immediately debar you from doing it. Obviously that leaves the problem, how do you find people? Absolutely no suggestion historically that Marcus Aurelius ever considered disinheriting Commodus, however many concerns he may have had about his suitability or maturity. I think this is an example of a filmmaker changing the story to suit a modern Western audience. We generally all believe in democracy as the fairest form of government, so for us to admire a historical figure, filmmakers wouldn't want us to see them being promoting an idea of autocracy and primogeniture. In other words, anointing your eldest son as heir to an empire. But if we're going to say Marcus Aurelius definitely, or as far as we know, definitely intended for his son to inherit, what are we basing this on? What are our sources?
There's two main contemporary sources for our history of Commodus. And these are writings by Cassius Dio, or Dius Cassius, as his name sometimes appears, who was a senator and would have known Marcus Aurelius and Commodus, and also subsequently served under a later emperor, Septimus Severus. The other main source is Herodian, who appears to have been a minor civil servant and who wrote entertaining narratives for Greek-speaking audiences. So bear in mind that the educated upper Roman classes and many slaves would have spoken and read Greek. It was seen as a sign of an educated man if you were a Roman citizen. So those are the only two contemporary sources that survive on Commodus, although later ancient historians also wrote on him many years after his death, probably drawing on those sources as well as others that are now lost. The Historia Augusta, a very suspect document in a lot of ways, and often reads more like a gossip column than serious history, was written hundreds of years after Commodus's time, and follows the line of Cassius Dio in condemning Commodus as a bad emperor.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to look, I think, not only what's written, but who wrote it. I mean, Commodus, like Caligula and Domitian before them, were castigated by the contemporary sources as being tyrants and bad emperors. Another common thread was that they all tried to neuter the Senate, surrounding themselves instead with a bureaucracy or civil service of educated slaves and freedmen, plus companions of their youth who advised them on state affairs. Most of the histories from antiquity that have survived to the modern era were written by senators or the educated servants of senators. And they're clearly going to have some cause for bias, and we do need to be mindful of that. And who were the Senate? Well, let's hear Senator Gracchus explain.
that the Senate is the people, sire. Chosen from among the people to speak for the people.
I doubt many of the people eat so well as you do, Gracchus.
Well, I hate to disagree with such a distinguished actor as Derek Jacobi, but no, the Senate were not chosen from amongst the people. And they might have said they were speaking for the people, but actually, if you think about the English aristocracy of the probably 1500s, 1600s, that's the sort of people the Senate were chosen from. The patrician class, as they were called, and although novus homo were promoted, new men who gained influence through military accomplishment or political accomplishment or through money, were promoted to the Senate. It was only really in time of need. And most of their laws, if you look back through the history of Rome and you read up on this, was based around making laws that suited themselves. But I do have to say, I think Ridley Scott or someone in the Gladiator production team was aware of this irony. And in an ironic twist, they gave the name Senator Gracchus to Derek Jacobi's character. The Gracchus brothers, Tiberius and Gaius, lived nearly 400 years before this, certainly over 300. And they were both reformers. They were both tribunes of the plebs. In other words, they were like the House of Commons in British politics. They were commoners, but fairly well-established ones and fairly prominent ones. And they tried to push through a series of land reforms to more fairly distribute the land held in Rome or in Italy, most of which was owned by members of the Senate. And it shouldn't surprise you to learn that they were both murdered on the orders of the Senate.
So it's fair to say that you could not get a more anti-senatorial name than Gracchus.
Exactly. So hats off to you, Ridley. I think that was a very nice little touch. But I'm sorry, please don't anybody think that Senator Gracchus represents the people. As you'll hear him describe later on, he doesn't see them as the people, they're the mob. Now, one of the very few modern biographies of Commodus, which is called The Emperor Commodus, God and Gladiator by John S. McHugh, is a very, very thorough and detailed book, and it casts a lot of doubt on Cassius Dio's condemnation of Commodus. The book's so detailed, I can't really recommend it as a good read unless you're doing research for, I don't know, a podcast. And also in his endeavour to revise the previous ideas about Commodus, McHugh almost becomes an apologist for an emperor who, even though he definitely has been a victim of some fairly strong propaganda, or at least he was once he died, he clearly did become paranoid and started to show really classic signs of megalomania, especially towards his later years. For example, he decided to change the name of Rome to Commodiana and the names of the month to reflect each one of his 12 names. I mean, he was born with, I think, three or maybe four names. He added a few like Hercules and Felix, which means happy and blessed by the gods. This was to demonstrate his goodness, his heroism, his high standing in the eyes of the gods, etc.
But history does tell us that Commodus was initially very popular with the people, exactly the same as Caligula, a reviled emperor in the earlier century. And so you start to get suspicious that there's been some, you know, bad propaganda after they've gone to blacken their names. And maybe Caligula and Commodus weren't as bad as history generally expects they were. Commodus did in fact throw lavish games to keep the people happy. And this is referred to in the film by Senator Gracchus, Derek Jacobi's role, when he says,
"Rome is the mob, the sand of the Colosseum. Commodus will bring them death and they'll love him for it." Sorry, that's my best Derek Jacobi impression.
Well done.
Thank you.
Commodus' sister that we've already mentioned, Lucilla, was also implicated in an assassination plot against her brother. There were several assassination attempts against Commodus. The film, I guess, compresses all of those into a single assassination attempt with Maximus and Gracchus and Lucilla. But history tells us that Lucilla was actually involved in at least one assassination attempt, which failed. There was an assassin that they selected, Quintianus. He leapt out at the emperor, surprising him with a dagger. and trying maybe to be too dramatic, pause to say, this is what the Senate sends you. That 2 or 3 second delay was long enough for Commodus's guards, the Praetorian Guard, his personal bodyguards, to jump in and overpower and disarm Quintianus. He was executed, as were the others implied in the plot. Commodus initially exiled his sister to the island of Capri, but soon after had her killed. And as mentioned before, she did have a son called Lucius Verus, named after the father with the same name. Lucius Verus, the child, plays a minor but significant role in the film. But in reality, he died at a relatively young age.
I think another aspect that's quite funny is interesting is the film. You kind of get the impression, you think, okay, he's travelled back from northern Germania, Maximus has to get to Spain. You know, maximum a year, minimum maybe 3 months Commodus reigned for before he died in the arena, killed by Maximus. In reality, he reigned for over 12 years, 180 CE to 192 CE. But what is another aspect that they've got absolutely bang on is he did appear as a gladiator, and he became obsessed with appearing in the arena, and he'd force senators and the populace to attend and cheer him on. What we have to think of here as well, and when you read into it, a gladiator or an actor or a prostitute were all seen as forms of entertainment, but they were seen at the same level as a slave. And they were absolutely viewed with disdain by the Roman aristocracy, certainly. However much they might cheer them on in the arena, to want to be one was just strange. So Commodus, who raced chariots and would fight as a gladiator, although often against other gladiators armed with wooden swords, apparently he would rarely kill other fighters, but he would always win. You know, for that would just lead these senators to look at him and think he's either mad or just deliberately trying to disgrace himself.
Yeah, and I guess there's echoes of Nero too. Nero, you know, was a bad emperor and was seen as wanting to be an actor and get popular approval, which, you know, over 100 years earlier would have shocked the Senate as well, I guess. So there's sort of echoes coming through of Nero and Caligula and Commodus.
Yeah, and I mean, Domitian, I don't know that Domitian ever, who was the last of, or was the the last emperor before the five good emperors began, and he was also murdered. The other common theme is him, Nero, Caligula, and Commodus all inherited the throne of the empire when they were either in their teens or very early 20s. Mm. I also think these days Caligula would have been assessed by a social worker and would have decided that his behaviour was completely understandable due to the trauma of his childhood. But that's really another story. We may one day do a post-Watershed R-rated version of this show where we'll examine the rather bizarre film, Caligula, but look at the history behind it. But coming back to Commodus, one thing that did definitely happen with him is he got a bit bored with the mundane administration of running the empire, which must be an enormous task. And I certainly believe that this is really where he alienated the Senate, because he found the most efficient way of running his empire was to hand control to a succession of increasingly corrupt and powerful Praetorian prefects and senior civil servants. They were very effective at telling him everything was fine, and they did run the empire. They had very, very depleted coffers or treasury after Marcus Aurelius's reign because of the expense of a lot of the campaigns that he'd gone on with the army. And as any government official will tell you, armies are very expensive. So they were regaining or replenishing the treasury, but unfortunately they were also at a far higher rate they were replenishing their own personal treasuries. Each of these successive civil servants or prefects would become a bit too powerful for Commodus's liking, and he'd have the man executed and replaced, or they'd have their own rivals, and if one of them gained the emperor's ear, his rivals would often find themselves implicated in plots and either executed or exiled.
At the start of his reign, he did something the emperor shouldn't do, and he put the army set against him to some degree. He decided, rather than keep fighting wars on the fringes of the empire with newly conquered tribes or peoples in the north and the eastern part of the empire, he decided to retreat from the recent territorial gains of his father, and gave up, you know, lots of land and surrendered money and control back to the people that were recently defeated by his dad.
He also alienated the nobility. He regularly topped up his treasury by accusing a family of treason, had them executed, confiscate their property or wealth, and then sell it off, or just, if it was cash, chuck it in the treasury. Or so we're told by Cassius Dio. More likely, in our opinion, he mistrusted the senators due to their habit of promoting laws and policies that benefited them at the expense of the general populace, or, as our beloved Senator Gracchus dismissed them earlier, the mob. And he thought, right, I'm going to clip their wings. I mean, one thing, during Commodus's rule, there was definitely a greater degree of social mobility than previously in the senatorial classes, as Commodus would promote people. But also, on the negative side, his corrupt civil servants would auction off high office to the highest bidder, regardless of their family history or social standing. This would have pleased the new men who were promoted, but as far as the patrician class went, they held their heritage above nearly any other measure of a man, and this would have absolutely horrified them.
And as I said before, the movie conflates several assassination attempts into a single failed one, and Commodus did in fact survive a number of assassination attempts. This served to reinforce the belief that he was a favourite of the gods. Eventually, though, one of the assassination attempts was successful, and he was murdered by a conspiracy that included his Praetorian prefect, Laetus, Commodus's mistress, Marcia, a few senior senators, and probably with the knowledge of his immediate successor as emperor, Pertinax, who's a senior general at the time and seemed pretty ready to take over. As part of the celebrations of the Saturnalia festival, which ran from mid to late December, the emperor would have been in a party mode, so Marcia, his mistress, poisoned his wine. Sources claim that Commodus drank it but then threw up while he was in the bath, or that he threw up first and then took his bath later to relax. In a panic that he would again survive in another assassination attempt, the conspirators sent in Narcissus, a slave wrestler who was the emperor's personal fitness coach and wrestling partner. Narcissus successfully strangled the emperor, and at last Commodus was dead. Although the film depicts his death in a manner and a reign very differently from reality, they did get the aftermath of his death pretty much bang on.
Senator Gracchus is to be reinstated. There was a dream that was Rome. It shall be realized. These are the wishes of Marcus Aurelius.
So, happy Hollywood ending. Rome returns to the wise and benevolent control of the Senate, and everybody lived happily ever after.
At the film's conclusion, Maximus's dying wish is that Marcus Aurelius's vision for a Rome to be returned to the people is fulfilled. Of course, when he says people, he means the Senate, which was run by a handful of the richest men in Rome, which they ran almost entirely for their own benefit. This didn't actually happen. Nor, as discussed earlier, was there any sign that Marcus Aurelius even wanted it to happen. Following the assassination of Commodus, there was a period of chaos which is known as the Year of the Five Emperors. And as you'll probably guess, that doesn't bode well. Some would say that Commodus's reign is the real start of the long, inevitable 300-year decline of Rome and its empire. There would be high points in the future, such emperors as Diocletian, Aurelian, and Constantine, but they were pretty brief plateaus on a long slope downhill. But if we think of a civilization that has been and gone, being seen as a trajectory, Commodus marks a point like two-thirds of the way through Rome's lifespan, at least as a great power. So it's clearly well past its zenith. Anyway, just so you know, a brief synopsis of the few years after Commodus' death runs like this.
The chaos started with Pertinax, who took over immediately after Commodus' death, ruled for 3 months, trying to overdo some of Commodus' mistakes, and upset too many people along the way and was soon killed. He did promise the Praetorian Guard, the bodyguard of the Emperor, a massive bonus if they supported him. But once he'd looked at the coffers, he tried to reduce this amount. And so the Praetorians weren't happy at all with his plan to clip their wings within the city. Pertinax was soon killed by a group of disgruntled Praetorians.
Following him, and this is, for anyone who's read up on Roman history, this is probably one of the most sordid and darkly comic episodes in the Roman imperial history, at least. Didius Julianus went running down, he was a senior senator, he went running down to the Praetorian barracks, shouting that he was willing to take over as emperor, because he'd heard that the Praetorians were basically holding an auction. Already inside was another senator called Sulpicianus, and they now did carry out effectively an auction, each trying to outbid each other. Didius Julianus outbid Sulpicianus in the end, and he became emperor, appointed by the Praetorian Guard, who all surrounded the Senate until the Senate said, okay. 12 days, though, after he became emperor, in name at least, Septimius Severus, who was governor of Pannonia Superior, which is basically the modern Balkans, also declared himself emperor and started a march on Rome, as did Pescennius Niger, who was the governor of Syria. So, Didius Julianus lasted 2 months, was deposed, captured, and executed.
So, just to pause there after all this chaos, we've got the Praetorian Guard based in the city of Rome, personal bodyguards to the emperor, deciding who is going to rule the empire based on whatever rich senator can offer them the most cash at the moment. And that's happened, you know, twice now. So what's happening in the rest of the empire? There's people ruling provinces with armies that have got nothing to do with these decisions the Praetorians are making in isolation in Rome. So when we've already mentioned two, we get Pescennius Niger and Septimius Severus that think they have a better claim on Rome, and they're starting to move in and try and restore some order to the chaos that is happening in Rome. The first of these we mentioned, Pescennius Niger, declared himself emperor and starts to fight a civil war with the other governor that's marching on Rome, Septimius Severus, that would last for 2 years until Pescennius Niger loses to Septimius.
Yeah, both very good generals. Severus supposedly, after the civil war was over and he was made emperor, said he could have really done with a general of Pescennius Niger's skill and talents. Unfortunately, he had slightly too much skill and talent and thought he'd make a better emperor. There was a third player here, Clodius Albinus, who was the governor of Britain and Spain. He started to make noises, and actually it's a funny story about him. A rumour had reached Britain saying that Commodus was dead before he actually was, at which point Clodius Albinus made a speech to his assembled troops saying Rome should be returned to be a republic, be given back to the Senate, Commodus had ruined it. Then the next message arrived saying, Emperor's not actually dead, and he's heard what you said and he's really annoyed. So he'd have probably been packing his bags thinking, I really hope someone discovers Brazil soon because I'm off there to hide on a coffee plantation. And then the word came through that actually Commodus was dead before any punishment arrived. So Clodius Albinus is a third player, but Severus neutered him by saying, look, I'll make you Caesar, which by then had been established as the junior emperor. The Augustus was the senior emperor and Caesar was the junior emperor. I'll make you Caesar if you run the empire whilst I'm away fighting Pescennius Niger. And Clodius Albinus lasted in that role for 3 years, which was really good, until Severus finished Pescennius Niger and then went, nah.
Yeah, I mean, not for the first time. Two people trying to rule the empire together end up coming to blows, and eventually one of them wants to be the sole ruler. And what happens next is Septimius Severus decides to, you know, continue the civil wars with Clodius, and the two of them, for several years, meet in battle at Lugdunum, modern-day Lyon in France. Cassius Dio would have us believe that the armies numbered 150,000 each, which would have made it the largest battle of Roman history to that point. So these figures are likely exaggerated. More likely, according to modern historians, that the combined numbers would have reached into six figures, although this still makes it a huge battle. Albinius was beaten and either killed himself or was captured and immediately executed, the same fate fell on his wife and two sons as well, as Severus removed any possible challenges to his new dynasty.
Yeah, I mean, Severus showed that he'd learnt some lessons from previous emperors, because the first thing he did when he arrived in Rome, or one of the first things, was he ordered the Praetorian Guard to assemble on their parade ground unarmed. And, of course, he'd arrived at the head of his veteran Danube legions, who had been fighting pretty much non-stop for 30 years. Not every individual, that was longer than a legionary's career, but they were very, very hardened and veteran. So he then said to the Praetorians, when he'd invited them or ordered them to parade, he had said, you know, you'll remain unharmed. They were, but they were disarmed, dismissed from their post, and banned from coming within 100 miles of Rome on pain of death, unless they earned their passage back to the Praetorian Guard by joining a provincial legion and being awarded it as a reward for brave or skilled service. That was a good policy, because it meant that the people being promoted to the Praetorian Guard were loyal to the man who got them there, the current emperor, in this case Septimius Severus. The downside was the frontier legions had all their best troops stripped from them, who went off to join the guard and get fat and happy in Rome.
So Septimius Severus brings some stability after the chaos of revolving door emperors immediately after Commodus's death. And, that's a good thing for Rome. But one lesson that Severus failed to learn was the trouble with bloodline successions. Marcus Aurelius to Commodus, father to son, was a disaster. And Severus did not learn the lesson and nominated his two sons, Geta and Caracalla, as his successors. There was intense rivalry between the two. Geta was murdered by his brother very soon before Rome had a chance to find out how capable Geta was or wasn't. And although Caracalla reigned for 6 years, these were not happy years for the empire. He proved a soldier first and an emperor a very poor second. He was noted for his cruelty and tyrannical tendencies, according to contemporary sources at least.
Septimius Severus, though, did buy Rome a breathing space. Fairly universally acknowledged as a strong and capable administrator and military commander, he was to die in modern-day York, England, at the age of 66, after 18 years of rule, which saw him restore much of the empire's fortunes, both literally and figuratively.
So, the conclusion. A great film for entertainment. Gladiator returned the sword and sandal epics to the big screen. Well, why did they change the ending from the historical ending? I guess because the truth is too depressing for any but the most stoic of audiences. After we've become emotionally invested in Maximus's struggle for justice, most people would have been left feeling it had been all for nothing if they'd just been told the subsequent chaos after the death of Commodus. All that would have been left was Maximus's personal quest for vengeance and justice, and we all want to believe that such sacrifice should be for a greater good.
However, in a way, I think what followed Commodus was for the greater good once you get past the chaos of the 2 or 3 years of civil war. When we look back at history, I think the further we look, the more time seems to compress. So to us, in the early 21st century, the Cold War looms large, especially with people like Andrew and I who grew up with the Cold War in full flow. However, in 1,000 years, do you think it's going to be anything more than a minor footnote, only noticed by students of history? I mean, it lasted less than 50 years. So for those living through the times depicted by Gladiator, or certainly the times that came after, they would, after a violent 2 years of civil war, emerge into more than a decade and a half of stable, consistent government. Do you remember the millennium? I'm guessing that both our listeners, or maybe we're down to one by now, was probably around at the millennium. Think that everything's happened since then. Twin Towers, invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, Arab Spring, global financial crisis, the ongoing recovery from that crisis, the arrival of smartphones, Wi-Fi, self-drive cars. Try and imagine the same time span under the single steady hand of a single ruler, in this case Septimius Severus. That's an unusually long period of stability by any measure. So if we can manage to view his achievements for the eyes of those who had lived with them or lived through them, it kind of gives us a different perspective. And that's something we're going to try and do with this podcast series. look at the events our movies portray from a perspective that history books and movies themselves don't always promote. Anyway, that's Gladiator. And I guess we should really give it a kind of mark. Now, we think we're going to split these marks. We're going to give one for entertainment and one for historical value or historical accuracy. For entertainment, I think I've got to go 9 out of 10.
Me, I give it 8 buckets of popcorn out of 10.
Yeah. I was torn between 8 and 9, but we'd said we're not doing half points. That's just a cop-out. So I remember seeing this on the big screen, and I loved it. For historical accuracy, I'm going to give them some props. And I don't mind historical inaccuracy done deliberately when it's for the purpose of showing us an element of the story that they don't have time to actually go into great depth. I do mind it when it's done to make us feel happy, because I prefer to have the harsh truth. So even though they do score quite a few points, the Lucius Verus touch is very good. I don't think I can give it more than 6 out of 10 for historical accuracy.
Yeah, I think I'm the same. 6 out of 10 possible Herodotuses.
Yeah, and of course Herodotus is the father of history, bless him. And of course we have ended up with 8.5 out of 10, because when we take the average of the two scores we gave. So we won't individually give half scores, but we may do.
Okay.
So, looking forward.
Yeah, next week we will examine much more contemporary events when we look at Ron Howard's movie Rush, which depicted the 1976 Formula One season and the rivalry between Austria's Niki Lauda and Britain's James Hunt.
As ever, you can email us at the show by writing to hosts@historybyhollywood.com, or you can follow us on Twitter @historybyhwood, or you can leave comments on the page at the website historybyhollywood.com. You can listen to each show as it's posted on the website itself, and we are going to be looking into streaming on YouTube for those who, you know, either don't like iTunes or have a problem downloading iTunes. So thank you very much. Please keep listening and send us your ideas for films you'd like us to include in the future, and we'll see where we can go with that. Do remember, please, we've had a couple of great suggestions from a listener on Twitter. I am very sorry. I've forgotten exactly who that was. I should have made a note of it. But the third suggestion was Debbie Does Dallas, and I'm not sure. There were two very serious ones, and I'm not sure that that's actually based in fact. And I'd also like to give out a big shout to Gary Shavit, who has the honour, and we have the great pleasure of Gary having become our first donor. Gary, thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary.
And it's really much appreciated. So it's good night from me.
And it's good night from him.
Good night.